Today's Teisho is on case 70 in the Book of Serenity. Case 70 is entitled Jinshan Asks About Nature. Introduction. One who hears the scent-bearing elephant crossing the river has already gone with the flow. Even one who knows that birth is unborn is stayed by birth. If you go on talking before concentration and after concentration, making bamboo shoots and making bamboo rope, you will be marking the boat when the sword is already long gone. Kicking the wheel of potential into motion, how can you particularly travel on one road? Let's try to bring this up. Case. Master Jashan asked Master Shuishan, clearly knowing the unborn nature of life, why are we stayed by life? Shuishan said, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, can you make them serve the purpose? Jashan said, later on, you'll get enlightened on your own. Shuishan said, I am just this way, what's your meaning? Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters, that is the cook's quarters. Shuishan then bowed. Verse, empty and at ease without dependence, lofty and serene untrammeled. Home and country peaceful. Those who arrive are rare. A little bit of power divides ranks and grades. The fluid, clear mind and body is beyond right and wrong. Right and wrong ended. Standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. So, this is undoubtedly, you know, one of the most beautiful sesshins we've ever had. You know, the weather is just astonishing, cool morning, crystal clear sky. The air has been scrubbed clean by the rains, and then probably rain again this afternoon. You know, beautiful, beautiful weather. Good to sleep, good to sit. It's so wonderful that, you know, in Buddhism, we say that something like a sesshin is the product of cooperating causes. And cooperating causes are many different factors that make it possible to have a sesshin. So, you know, For many years, this place has been trying to survive, Murray Grove. And they've had a series of really capable administrators who are just keeping it afloat, you know. I came here something like 18 years ago, something like that. And because I was looking for a place to have sesshin. We used to have sesshin at my house. Jaru was there. Some of you know Yen, who sits on Saturdays. He was there. Imtiaz, before Imtiaz married Kriti, Imtiaz was always coming there for sesshin, but it got to be too small for our group. And I began to look around for a place, and I heard that there was this, you know, very few places in New Jersey have appropriate facilities. There's a Buddhist group I had heard about that was holding its retreats in a motel. And I went to look at the motel, and it was a Chinese Buddhist group, and the motel was really right next to a main road, right? So I didn't think that, you know, they had good spirit, but I didn't think that was right. Many, many years ago, in our search for an appropriate place, Jara and I went into, I can't remember if it was Brooklyn or if it was Queens, but there was a group of Chinese Buddhist nuns there who were willing to let us use their place. And they were very nice, but I just thought, you know, driving into the city for Sesshin, and it was hard to find, you know, we would all have to go out and move our cars to the opposite side of the street every other day. So I just thought, I don't think this is going to, first of all, finding parking, right? But the alternate side, you know, parking, blah, 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 so I just didn't think, and they were so nice, and the nun there said she had assumed that I had had sort of like standard, I think, education that a Chinese monk would have. And she said, so what area of Buddhism did you do your, you know, dissertation on or something? And I can't remember what you did your degree on. And I can't remember what I said, but I think I said Zen or something, or I said Yogacara Buddhism or something. And she seemed quite impressed. And she offered us some tea, and she had some of the strongest tea I have ever had in my life. I think probably they just have like tea boiling all day long, day after day. And I remember when I drank it, it was delicious, but I think it put a hole in my stomach. So finally, you know, I drove down here to Murray Grove, and this was a total dump. It was so depressing. There were hardly any trees here. The building was unpainted. In fact, I thought it was an abandoned building. And I walked around the building, and I thought, there's no way. This is deeply depressing. But, you know, so we continued to sit at my house a couple more years, and then I came back here. They had really fixed it up. They had painted it. And over the years, they've worked so hard putting this place together. And you know, they've had a series of people running the place who are committed to, you know, gardening. And they've planted all these beautiful flowers, the baptisia and the, there's different, the clematises climbing up the poles. And there are irises everywhere. And somebody's done so much love and attention has gone into making this place what it is today. And we're so lucky because, you know, they just keep struggling to keep this place afloat. And so part of cooperating causes is simply having a place where you can actually do sesshin. And this place has been so wonderful. Also, having a teacher, very important. You can't really have a learning without a teacher. Practice without a teacher. And you can't have a practice without students who are capable and committed. I definitely think everybody in this room fits the bill of a capable and committed practitioner of Zen. It's absolutely delightful to practice with people who just go at it, you know, 100%. So causes and conditions have made this event possible. And other causes and conditions are like the fact that it's just so beautiful outside, You know, we actually had to cancel a session once in the middle of the session because of Hurricane Sandy. So we used to have an October session and we canceled it because the governor was closing the highways. So we ended, much to my chagrin, I really wanted to keep going, you know. I felt, you know, hurricane or not, you know, we should finish the session, but I was outvoted. So causes and conditions have made this possible. And it's easy to take those for granted, you know. When something like this happens, it's really magical. You know, when people come together with the right ingredients, you know, there are people who come to Sashin and they stay for a day and they jump in their cars. There are people who come to Sashin and don't benefit from practicing. Actually, they might get angry or hostile, you know. So everything is going so beautifully. I feel so fortunate to be part of this. It's like a mandala, right? This is like a mandala. And all the parts of the mandala come together and make a Bodhi mandala, which is a place of awakening. And a place where awakening can happen. And so, you know, this week, Murray Grove is a Bodhi mandala. Yeah. This koan is Master Jinshan asked Master Zhuishan. So you have two really Dharma brothers, right? Clearly knowing the unborn nature of life, why are we stayed by life? Zhuishan answers, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, can you make them serve the purpose? So, you know, the thing is, to understand that answer, you have to understand that there's a bamboo, if you know anything about bamboo, bamboo shoots are soft and pliant. And in fact, they're so soft and pliant that some species of bamboo can be cut, chopped up, and they're delicious, right? You can eat them. But when bamboo gets mature, it develops a very tough, sort of like husk or a leafy wrapper. You know, what we buy in the store, bamboo, is bamboo with the sort of like leafy wrapper taken off, and sometimes it just falls off, right? But you can take the outer part of the bamboo and you can make it into rope. This is commonly done in China, and even until recently, you know, people would make scaffolding out of bamboo, and the rope was made from bamboo too. You know, you see these huge scaffolds in places like Hong Kong, and they're made out of bamboo. I don't think they use bamboo rope anymore. That's probably not building code. But they used to. And so the whole thing was tied up with rope made from the bamboo itself. And this is really a wonderful metaphor, right? The question might not be clear, but, you know, intellectually, we know that the world is unified, right? We know that intellectually. We have, we've read books on Buddhist philosophy, you know, we're told, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences, when love and hate are both absent, and so on and so on. You know, we're told that, you know, this is, everything is one, the 10,000 things are as they are, etc., etc. This is all an intellectual understanding. If you read Buddhist philosophy, you know that Mahayana Buddhists believe that everybody has Buddha nature. Buddha nature. And also, you know, if we study even like biology, right, we learn that, you know, basically we're part of a living system. When you take a seventh grade, when I was in the seventh grade, we took a biology class, and it was all about living systems, earth systems, basically. And, you know, you can't have a grass without the oxygen. You can't have oxygen without these chemical reactions in the atmosphere, and so on and so on. And so we intellectually know everything is whole, and we know everything is Buddha nature. But, you know, in our daily lives, we may not, we often feel very far from that insight. You may feel very often anything but enlightened, anything but calm and serene, and anything but at one with your surroundings, right? So, I myself, definitely, I must confess, I hope people don't leave when I say this, but, you know, I definitely have moments where I sort of freak out, right? One of the things I dislike intensely is getting lost. You know, so if I'm driving, a few years ago, my wife and I were driving in Maine, in upstate New York, in the Adirondacks, and we were looking for this lake where there were supposed to be loons, and we got more and more. GPS doesn't work up there because it's so remote. And I had a map, but, you know, none of the streets corresponded to our maps. And as we kept, and my wife, this doesn't bother her at all. Barbara doesn't bother her at all. You know, so the map says you're going to be turning on Putnam Avenue. And we come up and it doesn't say Putnam, it says Grant. And then I think, well, we didn't pass Putnam. Did we pass Putnam? And Barbara might say, oh, who cares? And then, well, let's drive on. And the next one isn't Putnam either. And the next one isn't Putnam either. And you know, for me, this is like a vertiginous experience, right? This must have something in my childhood, right? But for me, this is like, I can feel my anxiety building. And I know rationally, you know, this is the Adirondacks. We're not going to die, you know. But it's very unnerving to me to get lost like that. You know, maybe it has a control issue, right? It's like the cognitive dissonance between what the map says and what's happening bothers me a lot. We all have things like this, right? We all have things like this. And there are moments when you might just feel like freaking out, right? I mean, and my wife will say, you know, why are you worried about this? You know, it's not that I fear we're going to be killed, you know, in the Adirondacks by hillbillies or something like that, you know. Or like those monsters in The Hills Have Eyes, if you've seen that movie. It's just the cognitive dissonance really bothers me. It's like, this is supposed to be Putnam, you know. We all have things like that, right? So, you know, it's possible you've had, if you have a friend or a life partner who doesn't do Zen, you know, they might say, I thought Zen was supposed to make you calm. You know, why are you freaking out right now? You know, This has happened to us a number of times. One time we were trying to find this arboretum outside of D.C. And again, we were getting more and more lost. And as we're getting more and more lost, I'm getting anxious. You know, and it's like the end of the world, right? And of course it's not. You know. And my wife, in some ways, there's sort of like a gender reversal. You know, the cliche is the man will never ask for directions, and the woman will always say, let's ask for directions. It's the opposite. You know, I will say, Barbara, let's just pull over into a gas station and just ask. And no, we can figure it out. And then we just get lost, more and more lost, more and more lost. And so, you know, I'm sort of like gripping the steering wheel if I'm driving, right? Like, this has got to end, you know, we've got to know, right? And if you have a partner, my wife has, you know, gently pointed out to me, you know, you don't seem much like a Zen master, right? You don't seem very masterly right now, you know? And it used to bother me. I used to think, yeah, what's wrong? I've been practicing all these years. Why should things bother me, right? You know. You know, I should be serenely greeting all events. You know, law, not a problem. You know, drive on. Fine. Instead, I'm, you know, like, about to jump out of the car as it rolls along, right? You know. You know, it's possible I'm a Zen failure, and it's possible I'm a big hypocrite, right? You know. But actually, you know, this is really like part of the practice, right? I mean, you know, ideally, we should always be pushing the boundaries of ourselves a little bit. You know, it's very important. Like the work we do with koans is about pushing the boundaries of ourselves a little bit, going to places that make us feel uncomfortable. So it would actually, I worry very much about Buddhism in America, because Buddhism in America is sold as a mental tranquilization device. You know, so mindfulness is marketed as a mindfulness in its classical Buddhist, richness is quite another thing. But the way it's marketed in the United States is as like a mental tranquilization strategy or technique. So you learn how to ground yourself in the present moment and enter a calm state. This is tremendously useful and very positive, but, you know, Buddhism is, or Zen, I would say, and Buddhism in general, is not just about entering a calm state. If that's all there was to it, it wouldn't be very good. It wouldn't be very good for us. It wouldn't really be different from taking a tranquilizer, right? I had friends in college, for example, who were, you know, I went to school in the 70s, and I had friends in college who were like, you know, big potheads, right? And I myself did not like pot very much, you know. I liked actually to worry a little bit, you know. So like I would read Sartre. You know, I was a humanities major. I was an English and anthropology major, and I read a lot of philosophy. And I would read stuff, and it would bother me. You know, I'd wake up at night thinking, you know, what is he talking about? You know. And, you know, I had friends who were sort of like stoner friends, like, you know, chill, dude, you know, it's all good, you know. It's like, well, I don't want it to be good, you know, I want to find this out, you know. And I actually commend myself for having that spirit. You know, I'm not that person anymore, but I respect that person. Because it's, you know, it would be a mistake to think that this is all about just being calm and tranquil. It's not about being on the edge of your chair with anxiety either. But it's definitely the case that you can't grow without encountering your obstacles and pushing through them. And that's a difficult process, you know. So Zen practice is really, it could be turned into a mental tranquilization regime. You know, in Zen history, there were definitely temples where people mostly just practiced to calm the waves. In fact, my second teacher, Webb, actually saw those words on the gate of a Buddhist temple in China. It said, calm the waves. So, basically people were sitting every day, you know, with the spirit of let's just calm down, be tranquil, a harmonious mind, and so on. And this is certainly a strand of Buddhist tradition. But you know, people like a lot of Zen masters got very upset about this. You know, like Lin Ji in particular comes in and he's, you know, basically says, you guys are just a He comes in and says to the monks, you know, you guys are just a bunch of good-for-nothings. You know, you sit on your asses all day and you're in this tranquil state and then you go in and have lunch and you eat your lunch and you go back and you're like cows eating grass, you know. Lin Ji could be a little bit polemical, you know. So I don't always like everything Lin Ji does, even though I am a follower of Lin Ji Zen. But he has a point, right? You know, it's very important to do the hard work of confronting ourselves, right? And working through our obstacles. And that involves moments of, you know, panic, you know, complete frustration, you know. It's okay to be like that sometimes, right? It's okay. You know, for me, you know, it's actually a good thing to get lost sometimes because I'm so uncomfortable, you know. And in fact, you know, I probably need to do more of that. I need to, you know, I'm comfortable in places like the city. You know, if I go into New York and I get lost, I'm not worried, right? I can just say, you know, can you point which direction is Fifth Avenue? You know, I'm totally lost. Somebody will point you. You know, but it's usually out in the sticks somewhere. A few years ago, I went backpacking with my old friend Larry Sullivan, and he likes to go out. I love to backpack, but I love to backpack on established trails, right? So actually, the trees have little lines painted on them, right? So you can actually, if you're getting lost, you look for they're called hash marks. And different trails have different colored hash marks. Sometimes a tree will have two hash marks, which means this is an intersection between two trails. And you get to an intersection, there's usually a little Forest Service sign, and it says, you know, river trail this way, overlook trail this way. You know, I love that. You know, it's like, it's all clear. But my friend Larry loves to just go off into, he calls it bushwhacking. Let's go bushwhacking, right? So we leave our packs and he just starts wandering with a compass, right? And it's just, it's both excruciating and boring, right? Because we're just, in my mind, we're just wandering around getting lost. Right? And he's fascinated. This is like fascinating to him. And I actually need to do more of that, right? Because it bothers me so much, right? You know, and I have disappointed him. He said, wasn't that great? It's like, well, you know, it's not really my cup of tea. I like a nice, well-marked trail, you know. So I should do the thing that makes me a little bit nervous more often. And one of the things we see in Zen koans is teachers encountering each other. And sort of, it looks like it's called sometimes Dharma combat, right? It's called one teacher encounters the other, and it's like these teachers are each pitching each other like koans, trying to get the other guy to get trapped in their evil spell, right? You know, so basically the Zen masters are. It looks like it's a power dynamic, but I don't really think it is. I don't think I'm apologizing for the tradition. I think people seek out. These Zen teachers were very accomplished, and they were seeking out people who could challenge them. See? I mean, I will sometimes have dokusans with students, and the thing the student says is really eye-opening for me. You know, it's like, I never experienced the koan that way. That's so interesting. Years ago, I had an experience with a teacher who's now deceased, it was one of the nicest moments in my life because in Zen tradition, sometimes when you go to meet a new teacher, he will ask you to work on mu, even if you've worked on mu, and he will actually say, "I want to hear your mu, right? I want to hear your ability to lose yourself." In this trusting relationship with the big mind. I had studied with Genki Roshi and Webb Roshi, and I went to study with this deceased Japanese teacher in upstate New York. And I was, I was working on the Mu Koan, and this a lot of people at his place were working on the Mu Koan, and they'd come in and they'd just go, "Mu," you'd go, "Mu." They were just screaming themselves hoarse. And actually, I went in at one point and I was calling Mu, and I actually got hoarse, from calling Mu. And then I realized, there's more to Mu than just screaming your head off, And I couldn't scream my head off anymore because I had blown out my vocal cords. And I just realized, actually, that I really loved this old Japanese guy, And he had many personal defects. But he was a fascinating person, and I really loved practicing with him. And I went into the Dokusan room, and I leaned over and I whispered in his ear, "Mo, mo." And his eyes got big, and he said, "Nobody has ever done that, And it wasn't the novel. He got exactly what I was getting at. It was like a love letter to him, basically. And it was like, there's a dimension to the Mu, which is this beautiful, loving gentleness, right? And his eyes got big. It just blew him away. We became friends for many years after that. I was trapped and I was boxed in, and it wasn't so much that I wasn't trying to figure out how can I impress this guy, I was struggling with how to be with Mu, and it just came to me, it's like my big mind gave me an idea, gave me another way to go forward. But the struggle was really essential. I discovered that too. It wasn't something I planned in advance. It hit me like a ton of bricks too. And And I learned as much as he did from the process, right? It was news to me too. You know, if you had asked me 2 days ago, I wouldn't have had a clue. So if we're trying to be tranquil and in control all the time, we can't grow and learn. And, you know, we need to play the boundaries a little bit in ourselves. And that's what koan training is all about. You know, many people, some people don't like koan training because it pushes you to that difficult place, right? It pushes you into a place where you're not the boss anymore. You don't have all the answers. And that's exactly where we should be sometimes. I mean, there's a place for quote-unquote mastery too, right? I mean, I was teaching a class once and I was, you know, some student raised a question about some passage and I looked at it and I said, you know, I haven't a clue what that means. And actually I got like negative marks on the SIRS evaluations of the course, you know. People questioned my credibility or something. It's like, and I tried to say, look, you know, experts don't know either, right, you know. Some people expect you always have an answer, but you can't grow, obviously. And so this is another aspect of the trusting mind. If you don't trust your big mind, if you don't trust your Buddha nature, you tend to avoid the challenges, right? You tend to avoid those challenging moments. That's a sign of not trusting. Trusting big mind means I'm going to allow myself to get flummoxed. I'm going to allow myself to get lost. I'm going to allow myself to cry or to be angry, pissed off, you know, whatever. And I'm not going to be, nothing is worse than trying to be perfect, right? Or trying to be always calm, always sweet. You know, that's very contrived. Sometimes you have to get angry. You know, so you don't want to punch somebody, but sometimes you need to confront your own responses to things. You know, in our Zen community in Seattle, we had a lot of tension because people didn't know how to deal with their disagreements and their anger. And people in our Sangha in Seattle always felt like Buddhists should always be calm and loving. And so, you know, we had a place that was our residential center. And, you know, people wouldn't do the dishes when it was their day. You know, and this created major problems because somebody should just have gone in and said, God damn it, you know, it's your turn to do the dishes, right? And then, you know, but that person was afraid to do that. Everybody would go, oh man, that's real hostility, you know. That's showing a lot of hostility, you know, very un-Buddhist. You know, so, but, you know, it's okay to say, listen, it's your job. It's okay to raise your voice and say, God damn it, do the goddamn dishes, you know. But people couldn't do that, and so it created many social tensions. It had many negative effects on our community. People became very gossipy. You know, so sometimes I would go out, if I had time after a morning sit. We used to sit in the mornings because we had a place in the city. And we would all go for coffee after the sit if we didn't have to run off to work or school. And, you know, people would sit there. I'd hear people go, oh, did you hear what she said? Oh, you know, or did you hear? And Joyce Victor, who was one of the people in our group and who was a psychotherapist, you know, she used to say her husband, Bill Kubler, was really one of my best friends. And when I'd go over to dinner, she'd say, you know, you are the gossipiest group I've ever seen. You know, you Buddhists are really gossipy. You know? But it was because they couldn't, you know, they didn't want to go to these different, it's difficult, you know, to confront somebody. I myself hate confrontation, you know. So it's difficult to confront somebody and say, you know, it's, you're not murdering somebody if you yell at them, right? Because they're not doing their job. You know, and, but people were, they couldn't work that out, right? They wanted to have all, you know, people were supposed to come to the Zen, Seattle Zen Center. Everybody was loving and kind. Everybody was generous. And, you know, it's a very, they couldn't work out their issues, right, in a social setting. And it, the community fell apart because they didn't want to admit that, you know, this is a, sometimes things are going to be a crazy mess, right? They're going to be a crazy mess. You work through a crazy mess to something better, right? But if you don't allow a crazy mess to take place, you can't learn anything. So it's, you know, when things are in shambles, you know, nobody likes that feeling, but that's a natural process that something, a new order is emerging. So if you trust the big mind, you know that there's no such, it's not like things are going to crash down and be irreparably shattered, right? That never happens. Things, there's always an order. There's always a coherence to things. Even in the middle of all the chaos, it's emerging. It's like we don't understand it yet, but it's always already there. It's like if you look at a Persian carpet the wrong way, it just could look like chaos. But when you step back, you see it, right? If you're an ant climbing on a, making your way across a Persian carpet, it's just one color after another. But if you can step back 100 stories in ant stories, right, and look down, you see a pattern. And that's what we trust, we Zen people trust, is that it's okay to go into, quote, chaos. It's okay to go into unhappiness and disorder, because there's always an order there already that we're not noticing. And trusting in that order is that the reality of that order is the trusting mind. And trying to be tranquil, and I'm not saying you should now, you know, be a bully or something, of course, but trying always to be sweet and kind doesn't work because it's arresting you. It's preventing you from developing genuine compassion, right? Because you're trying to preserve the facade of compassion, right? So you know, even people like the Dalai Lama, whom I totally revere and love, you know, he too plays into this. You know, he's always laughing and giggling, and it would be okay if the Dalai Lama showed us sometimes his anger, you know? If he said that, you know, Chinese invasion of Tibet is an outrage, and just, you know, basically, you know, let the Chinese have it. You know, probably diplomatically he can't do that because he's always trying to work some arrangement out. But he's always so sweet. It's a little bit false as an impression of what it means to be an awakened person. Sometimes you have to, you know, I don't think I've ever raised my voice at anybody I work with, ever, and I don't like to do that. But sometimes you just have to say, you know, this is, you really blew it here, you know? This is really not, you know, this is really not working out. And you have to be careful of people's feelings, but you know, and sometimes you make mistakes. You know, you're too assertive. You hurt somebody's feelings, and you think, "Oh my God, why did I do this?" But if you're backing, if you don't like that experience of maybe making a mistake, maybe having hurt somebody's feelings without intending to, or You get into a big mess, but if you're afraid of that mess, you can't have relationships. And you can't have friendships, you can't have working relationships either that are effective. Master Jiashan asked Master Zhuishan, clearly knowing the onboard nature of life, why do we get into a big mess? Zhuishan said, you know, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them to make rope now, they're just gushy, soft pieces of vegetable matter. They won't make a good rope. You have to go through the process. You have to go through the process. It'll become firm and trustworthy, but not yet. Jiashan said, later on, you'll be enlightened on your own. Zhuishan said, I am just this way. In other words, what are you driving at? Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That is the cook's quarters. Zhuishan then bowed. Things have a way of working out. They will work out. They always work out. So please trust the process. Empty and at ease, without dependence, lofty and serene, untrammeled. Home and country peaceful, those who arrive are rare. A little bit of powder, of power, divides ranks and grades. The fluid, clear mind and body is beyond right and wrong. Don't worry about making, doesn't mean there's no bad. It means doesn't mean you can break the precepts. This is often misunderstood in Buddhism. No right and wrong means don't worry about always being right. Sometimes it's okay to be wrong. Right and wrong ended. Standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. Life never gets stale if you're willing to go to those, you know, crazy places. Shujo Muhen.